This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun. Welcome to Not Your Grandma's Bible Study. We're back again.
I am not your grandma.
I'm not either, but I am Jill.
And I am Zach.
Might be your aunt,
but not your grandma.
Uncle Grandma.
I'm your Aunt Dr. Grandma, Jill.
Dr. Grandma.
Dr. Grandma. Oh my gosh. This is already off the rails and we are 30
we're,
seconds
we're
in.
We're 30 seconds in.
Awesome. This should be good.
It's going to be a good episode.
This is going to be part two of the synoptic problem.
Ooh.
So that being said, if you haven't listened to part one, stop. Go listen to part one. I'm going to briefly review what we went over in part one, but you might still get lost in part two if you don't. So, and regardless, you should go listen to it because I think there might be a couple of good jokes in there. I don't know. I think I'm really funny. Okay, so just as a little mini review of what we talked about in the first episode. So the central question of the synoptic problem is how do we make sense of the literary differences and similarities in Matthew, Mark, and Luke? John is not at play here.
Nope.
Although I have heard that there are scholars trying to figure out a way to bring John into the conversation, but I don't know what that looks like.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. I mean, unless you want to. But
depends on what your project
don't
is.
Don't expect us to do an episode about it.
We're not going to talk okay. about John.
We're not talking about John today. John is out.
Hair swish.
Hair swish. Bye, Felicia. Oh, still off the rails. Let's get it together. Okay. Some key terms you need to know. One, triple tradition. That is material that is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Mm-hmm.
Double tradition. Material found only in Matthew and Luke. And then you have special M, which is material unique to Matthew,
mm-hmm.
and special L, material unique to Luke. And there is no term for the couple of stories in Mark that are unique to Mark.
Poor Mark.
Poor little Mark. But that's in part because most scholars agree Mark was written first.
Right.
So technically then all of Mark is special Mark. Matthew and Luke are using
Mark's just Mark. Very special.
Mark was real special. So there are five heads of evidence, quote unquote, developed by Burnett Streeter in the 1920s, I think.
Somewhere in there.
Early 1900s. I'm trying to make sense of this. The first argument from content, over 90% of Mark is reproduced in Matthew and over 50% is reproduced in Luke. Arguments against this, specifically from Dungan, are that doesn't prove anything other than that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are in literary relationship. Doesn't indicate which one was first. There's an argument from wording. So in the triple tradition, either Matthew or Luke agrees with Mark. Rarely do Matthew and Luke agree against Mark.
Right.
Argument against this one is that those places where Matthew and Luke do agree together against Mark are far more important and really need to be wrestled with in a way that Mark and prioritists, or those who believe Mark was written first, don't take seriously. They kind of atomize them and then
mm-hmm.
it dissipates the evidence and it gets dismissed. Argument from arrangement or from order. So wherever Matthew departs from Mark's order, Luke supports Mark. Mm-hmm. And whenever Luke departs from Mark's order, Matthew supports Mark. So Matthew and Luke never depart at the same time from Mark's order in the triple tradition.
Right.
Argument against this. That doesn't really indicate that Mark was written first. It might indicate that Mark was written last. So it doesn't actually prove anything definitively. Argument from style, head of evidence number four. This argument states that Matthew and Luke improve Mark's grammar, style. They're more reverent in their portrayal of Jesus. Arguments against this. E.P. Sanders' study has indicated that early Christian writings often expand traditions or, you know, minimize traditions or change things or ignore things. There's really not any clear pattern for why these choices are made. Everything kind of goes in all directions. So that's really not an argument that makes any sense. So, or makes any point.
Right.
You might be able to say that Matthew is stylistically better than Mark, but that doesn't mean Matthew improved Mark.
Correct.
So sort of a false conclusion. I'm sure there's some Latin way of saying that. Argument from what I call particularity, and this argument states that the particularities of Matthew and Luke's arrangement of their sources indicate that they're working independently.
Hmm.
Note that it's of their sources, plural, So the argument against this is that this argument already presumes Mark is first and that Q exists.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no physical evidence of Q if you ignore the double tradition.
Right.
Okay, so Kloppenborg, he's a big Q scholar now in our day and age. He notes, you know, that these heads of evidence can go either way. I mean, that's right. Sort of where the field stands now. There's a recognition that none of these heads of evidence are particularly conclusive in and of themselves. So now what's at stake is who has the best cover story for the evidence, who makes the best sense of their story.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to discuss the four biggies of the cover stories. So we talked about this first one in the first episode. This is the four document hypothesis. This one was the one promoted by Burnett Streeter in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
He argues Mark was written first. Matthew and Luke used Mark independently of one another, so they didn't know the other was writing, but that they also used Q. Again, that's a shorthand for the German word Quelle, which just means source. For as creative as Streeter was in this hypothesis, he couldn't have come up with a better word. Anyway, I'm not gonna get hung up on that again. I'm gonna let it go. So Q is a hypothetical, and that's a very important hypothetical source that accounts for the double tradition material. So then Matthew has his own traditions and Luke has his own traditions, and that's why it's the four document hypothesis. So Mark, Q, special M, special L. So sometimes this is considered the two document hypothesis with just Mark and Q being the sources for Matthew and Luke, with the generalized sort of assumption that all three gospels have their own unique material, their own unique traditions. So that's sort of the big dominant hypothesis to this day, is this four document or two document hypothesis.
Most scholars subscribe to this.
Griesbach, we talked about him. He wrote before Streeter, so these are not in any particular order. and then he argues, he sort of follows the Augustinian approach of canonical order. So he argued prior to Streeter, and he sort of opened up this discussion with the publication of his synopsis, showing, you know, on a page that you can see these similarities and these differences. He argued Matthew was written first, and then Mark used Matthew, and then that Luke used Mark. And so that's another option for making sense of the materials. He didn't need a fourth document there. He didn't need a Q or a second document, I guess. Dungan, who was very critical of Streeter, he argues that so Griesbach is a Matthean priority and Lucan posterioriist. So this is sort of the differences, like the moving of the parts. So Streeter is Mark first, Matthew and Luke separate and second. Luke was probably written later than Matthew, but Luke was not familiar with Matthew or didn't use Matthew. Griesbach argues Matthew was written first, Luke was written last, Mark's in the middle.
Right.
Dungan also argues that Matthew was written first, and then that Luke used Matthew, and that Mark used both Matthew and Luke, combining and abridging them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last of the cover stories is Mark without Q. A big proponent of this is, I think his first name is Mark Goodacre.
Yep.
He argues Mark was written first, so he does sort of line up with a scholarly consensus of Mark and priority there. But then he argues that Matthew used Mark as a source, plus some of his own independent traditions, and that Luke used both Matthew and Mark, plus some independent traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got some different orderings of how these three can be made sense of. And one of the things all of these cover stories are doing is trying to explain the literary relationship. Nobody's saying the three gospels didn't know each other. There was some connection. Even if you say Luke and Matthew didn't know each other, they both knew Mark and they're connected in that capacity. Or maybe Luke didn't use Matthew specifically, but he inadvertently used Matthew because he used Mark, kind of thing. So there's never a moment in this discussion where anybody is saying that these three gospels came up without any knowledge of one another at all.
Mm-hmm,
there is some connection between them, and it is textual,
mm-hmm.
not just orality. Although there are some discussions around that now, that yeah. some of these, what we would consider really unique verbal agreements that we just can't seem to make sense of anyway, oral tradition really does, can really make sense of that. We're not an oral culture to fully understand how those stories can mm-hmm. get passed down and how certain wordings can get fixed in a way. And they would argue too that some of the slight differences that we see in storytelling would just be, you know, maybe Luke and Mark and Matthew, all three knew the same story, just knew it slightly differently. Yeah. And that explains some of the differences
yeah.
without having to posit really any kind of relationship there. But
mm-hmm.
Synoptic Problem doesn't take too much of orality stuff into consideration mm-hmm. once they move past talking about the gospel.
So quick question. Which of the four cover stories do you find? It, I mean, not that you have to like stake
I'm
your flag.
I'm probably a Mark without Q. I don't think Q is necessary to make sense of it. I understand. I don't understand why some people want to believe it. I understand why. I mean, it does give us a new toy in the playground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I remember, you know, when the Dead Sea Scrolls came out, that gave us a bunch of new toys in the playground. So one of the things around Q is that it's considered a saying source because
yes.
most of what's in Q, the double tradition, is teaching material.
Yeah. Stuff attributed to Jesus saying.
Stuff attributed to what Jesus said. And so at some point in the last 50 years, I can't remember what, the Gospel of Thomas
right.
was discovered.
Right.
And because there wasn't really any evidence of a saying source like this prior. So when Thomas was discovered,
was
first
a
of all,
huge thing.
Q scholars were like, we found Q.
This is it.
It's not Q.
It's not
the same material, but it is a saying source. So a document like that just really tracks the teaching of Jesus in sort of these anecdotal
mm-hmm.
series is a document that could exist. And
yeah.
so that ended up confirming even more Q could have been real.
Yeah.
Maybe Q will show up in a clay jar in the desert someday and all of these scholars will be right. But I think without it, there are ways to make sense of it without Q. And that's sort of where Mark without Q folks fall, is that
yeah.
we can make sense of these three without positing
without
a hypothetical
Q.
source.
Yeah.
Why can't we believe that Luke and Matthew knew each other? Like, why is that
yeah.
such an impossibility? I mean, all of these gospels, there's lots of evidence in early Christian traditions of gospels being written in
mm-hmm.
response to one another, of abridging, of
mm-hmm.
expanding. And
mm-hmm.
one of the things I find interesting, and I maybe somebody discusses this and I just haven't run across it, is so, you know, the general consensus is Mark abridges Matthew. But one of the stories I think is really interesting is the Gadarene demoniac in Mark 5.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, the Gerasene demoniac in Mark 5 and the Gadarene demoniacs in Matthew
mm-hmm.
8
mm-hmm.
are the same story.
Yeah.
With variations. But Mark's version of that story is expanded dramatically from Matthew's.
Yeah.
Much more abridged. And so Matthew overall is a much larger gospel.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there are pockets of stories where Matthew's or where Mark is actually the longer version of the story. And
mm-hmm.
so I would be interested in
yeah.
seeing if anybody's really played with how does that, because we just want to talk about, it doesn't make sense that anybody would want to shorten the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mark, if you're arguing that Matthew used Mark in this one story, then Matthew did shorten it.
Mm-hmm.
But you've said it doesn't make sense
yeah.
on a big scale. Why does it make sense on a small scale?
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
so I think Mark without Q makes some sense. I'll propose, once we get through this a little bit, I'll propose a third option.
Sure.
I haven't done any research on it to know
sure.
Really, but maybe it's something that's possible for
mm-hmm.
my future if I decide to go down the cat hoarding, crazy woman in a robe, never showering, corkboard scenario. Where do you think you fall on it?
I think I like Mark without Q. I think I like the four document a little better. And I think, as we mentioned before, with get out of this room.
Get out.
You're done. You're off the podcast. This is it.
Right. This is not your grandma's Bible study with Jill. Only from
only
now
Jill.
On.
Jill's. No, I like four document because related to something you said about the scrolls, in that though it's not a direct connection, but if you read through a bunch of the different scrolls material, you find a lot of other stories about Abraham and Moses. So I'm thinking in Jubilees, I'm thinking in Genesis Apocryphon. So all these other texts that are orbiting the same universe
okay.
in a sense. So there was a community that obviously held texts as authoritative, but they also had different stories about them too. And those were passed down and kept. So the idea of not so much, I mean, Q, I realize if I say I can take or leave Q, that kind of shoots a big hole in the four document hypothesis. But actually, I like the idea more of special L and special M, mm-hmm. and the idea that there were actual communities in which, like the Methean communities and the Lucan communities, that actually had their own material about something right. that actually was specific to them. And so I kind of like... That seems to resonate more with the idea that there was a lot going on rather than maybe just these three big documents right. that circulated. That there was piecemeal things that were maybe happening on the side.
So maybe you wouldn't be surprised if a Q turned up.
I would not be surprised if a Q turned up, just with the way that, I mean, you could look at archaeological finds in the last 100 years mm-hmm. between the Cairo.
Or that a Q already exists somewhere in yeah. somebody's basement.
Could be.
And they end up selling it. Or that.
Or they don't even know what they have.
Or it got destroyed.
I mean, but, yeah. I mean, I was, one of my favorite archaeological finds was the Cairo Geniza, which literally is a mausoleum for dead texts.
Yeah.
Like, it was a trash heap of, like, texts, and we found them, and we started to understand so much more about yeah. the ancient world from correspondence and, you know, business transactions and things like that. So, literally, it could be sitting in someone's antiquated trash heap, and we just have to find it.
I'm going to check my desk later.
See what's there. Speaking of antiquated trash heaps. Maybe you have Q on your desk. So, I think there's a lot, and just even thinking about how the Septuagint interacts with, I mean, mm-hmm. again, proved by the scrolls that the Septuagint actually had access to older texts mm-hmm. than the Masoretic does, which for a long time we thought the Masoretic was obviously yeah. the correct choice in terms of what represents the oldest text right. that's available, but the Septuagint proves that it actually had access to older stuff. So there's a lot. All
Q
that,
people need to bring some of this into their discussions.
Bottom line.
Because now I'm like, maybe.
Bottom line is there is so much from antiquity that does not exist
yeah,
anymore.
Lost
and,
to history.
And we have evidence that it did exist mm-hmm. In other spots of biblical scholarship. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if Q exists.
And it may not even be, Q may not look like what scholars think
it
looks
it does,
like.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible. There are other gospels that still exist to this day. Mm-hmm. You know, Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Thomas, Infancy Gospel of James, things like that, Infancy Gospel of Thomas. So there are lots of other gospels that were in existence, and it's entirely possible there was another gospel
mm-hmm.
that is just lost to us. I mean, the earliest scraps of New Testament texts that we have are from like this late second century, I
yeah.
think.
Yep.
And so it's entirely possible that 100 years, lots of stuff could have gotten lost and mm-hmm. just decided, I mean, maybe Matthew, Mark, and Luke rose to the top because the gospel that Matthew and Luke mm-hmm. were using in addition to, or one of them was using or whatever, they were like, ah, well, the best parts of it are already here. So,
exactly.
you know, these three became superior in a way. So who knows? But yeah, I mean, I think that right now there's a way to make sense of it without Q. And until there is a Q, I don't need it. So, and also, I mean, redaction critics make a big deal of this. Redaction critics are those who would look at Matthew and see what changes Matthew is making to Mark and then what that might indicate about Matthew's community, things like that. I am of the opinion that there are very few instances where changing the source material in light, the fact by looking at how did Matthew change Mark or Luke change Mark makes better sense of Matthew and Luke other than just noting.
Sure.
Like, okay, so an example I'm thinking of is the Canaanite woman
mm-hmm.
in Mark when Jesus calls her a dog, just says, but even the dogs get crumbs. In Matthew, she says, yes, but even the dogs get crumbs.
Mm-hmm.
And so much is put on this yes
yeah.
as a distinction from Mark. And I'm like, you don't need Mark to note that this agreement before the rest of the sentence. You don't need there to be a first or second who changed who
yeah.
involved in this
mm-hmm.
just to note that that agreement first means something to Matthew. You don't. You could never have
Mark
and,
yeah.
and think of that. You know, so I don't think there are too many instances, and I'm sorry for all your redaction critics out there who are rolling over in your graves. I just don't think there are that many instances where it actually matters which one was written first.
Probably not.
Maybe I'm wrong. I'm just a fledgling little scholar here. Okay, so the thing I really want to talk about for the rest of this is some problems for consideration.
Yeah.
So some of the unquestioned tendencies in this debate that I really want to sort of illuminate, because I think that they, I just think that they're important to be aware that we're making assumptions all throughout this. And so what are some of them that should be exposed? So first of all, I find problematic this hunt for the historical, if you will.
Yes.
So behind a lot of this work of the synoptic problem is an attempt to get at the historical Jesus. The idea that Q is even earlier than Mark, and it might reflect communities living in the 40s and 50s of Jesus believers in a different way than what Paul is illuminating, mm-hmm. Writing in the 50s. So this dark decade, I think, from 40 to 50 is sort of what they think Q is really illuminating. So the idea here is that if one can figure out which of the Gospels is earliest, then perhaps one can get at which Gospel is most reliable for studies of the historical figure of Jesus.
Right.
The difficulty with this approach is that, like, even as early as Paul, who's, again, writing in the 50s, the distinctions between Jesus of history and the Christ of faith are already being collapsed.
Oh, yeah.
So Paul is not concerned with the man Jesus. He is very concerned with the crucified Christ mm-hmm. in the 50s.
Yeah.
That Christology of Paul's is already very high
mm-hmm.
in the 50s, 15 to 20 years after Jesus's death.
Mm-hmm.
So these early Jesus followers who wrote these gospels, these different communities, they weren't necessarily concerned with recounting this objective timeline of Jesus's earthly activities, but they wrote their documents, these documents that were intended to be exhortatory or persuasive in
mm-hmm.
nature.
Mm-hmm.
So when Goodacre, for instance, comparing the synoptics, writes, quote, "And one inevitably finds oneself asking interesting historical questions. Why are Matthew and Luke more reverential in their portrait of Jesus?
Mm.
Why does Mark apparently paint the disciples of Jesus in such a negative light?" End quote. Like, in those questions, we can see this search for historicity at work. And so behind Goodacre's question, I think, is the assumption that one of these gospels is closer to the actual events than the others.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem then with Goodacre's questions is it's not that they're necessarily historical questions. I think narrative criticism, for instance, lends itself really well to these types of questions. Why are Matthew and Luke more reverential in their portrait of Jesus than Mark? Perhaps those communities had higher Christologies in place than Mark's community did.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're working with a high Christology like Paul has, rather than a lower Christology. I mean, because one of the arguments is Q. So Q is essentially anything that's not in Mark, right? Anything double tradition that doesn't occur in Mark. Occasionally there's a Mark Q overlap, and that's a whole different discussion.
That's a different episode.
But because of that, what that leads scholars to believe then is that Q does not have a passion narrative, because
right.
the passion narrative is triple tradition.
Yep.
So the argument there is then that Q has a very low Christology because Q does not include passion narrative.
Yeah.
It's just teaching. So yeah. that's a low Christology for the crucifixion to not mean anything.
Especially for people who are looking
just
for
Jesus teaching. Yeah. So you've got this low Christology, maybe alongside these high Christology. Maybe Mark's community, you know, just has a lower Christology. It's possible. So hunt for historicity is one of my issues, and I think there are other ways to think about these texts. Not that those are inappropriate questions, but that sometimes they can't be answered.
Right.
And if they can't be answered, calm down. There might be other ways to think about them. Another one is this idea of theological development in early Christianity. So this is a little bit complicated, I think, maybe. The emphasis on the historical and how to get at it really leads me to challenge this assumption of an evolutionary model of early Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So now, admittedly, these scholars aren't stating it that way, but the types of argumentative moves in this discipline seem to be guided by the hand of orthodoxy. So what becomes the orthodox tradition? So
mm-hmm.
considering Streeter, he cites Irenaeus's defense of only the four gospels in adversus heresis. So I guess against heresies. And within this, Irenaeus compares the four gospels to the quadriform living creatures in Ezekiel 1. So Streeter here concludes that to the modern reader, language like this seems fantastic, but it is supremely interesting for what it implies. No one, even in that age, could have used it except about books whose sacrosanctity was already affirmed by a long tradition. So Irenaeus would only call these four gospels, kind of name them after the four living creatures in Ezekiel 1, because they're so holy.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this evolutionary model there in place. But prior to arguing this stuff with Irenaeus, Streeter argues that the canonization of the New Testament was in part a reaction to Marcion's movement. So early influential Christians like Irenaeus were compelled to respond to Marcion.
Mm-hmm.
That they were indicates that Marcion, this heretic, also had some influence if he had to be commented upon.
Right, yeah.
So this assumption that Streeter's assumption here that the canonized gospels were then affirmed by a long tradition betrays his evolutionist assumptions,
mm-hmm.
you know, lets you know, like, he's assuming this sort of evolutionary path, even while he's fully aware that Marcion was causing quite the stir.
Yeah.
That it wasn't as lockstep as he wants to believe that it
mm-hmm.
was.
Mm-hmm.
This overlooks the moves for power that were being made by these competing Christologies in the early church. And I think it entirely misses that Irenaeus was not so much recounting a fact about these gospels as much as he was creating a reality in mm-hmm. these gospels. So, well, some of these Markan prioritists are really comfortable with the diverse early Christianity. And in fact, they require it to make sense of Q's lack of a passion narrative. So again, this diversity in Christology levels, because Paul could never not have a passion. Paul could never not have a crucified Christ, but then Q seems to not have it at all.
Right.
So they often perpetuate the model that the early diversity progressed into what would later become orthodoxy. So rather than imagine this time of theological competition and lively debates about identity formation, so what we now call Gnostic traditions, Marcion, what later be this proto-orthodox stuff, rather than imagining all of this conversation and debate happening, and it's not even the most popular perceptions that win, it's just the loudest and the most powerful that later become orthodoxy. Not necessarily the most popular. A good example of this is the infancy gospel of Thomas about Jesus as a boy when he's a real turd. We have an episode about it. That does not become part of orthodox tradition,
mm-mm.
but that text is popular way into the late Middle Ages.
Yep.
Really popular. This idea of, you know, the refusal to imagine those competitions and debates then presents this image that of this lockstep movement towards the goal of one identity, that there wasn't really, that everybody was falling in line, and everybody certainly was not falling in line. In a recent monograph on Marcion, Judith Liu describes the dynamic of the second century this way. She writes, "It appears as a time rich in discontinuities when straightforward developments are difficult to trace or to predict, and as a time of experimentation when ideas, structures, and patterns of behavior are being explored. A sense of sharp differentiation is being widely evoked in the literature." So then I think that a problem with Streeter's view, and some that follow Streeter here, is that it assumes a really evolutionary approach and then plots the Gospels on that trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's moving towards orthodoxy. So this idea of reverentialness and blah, 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 he can't imagine a diversity of Christologies and beliefs and values within these three Gospels outside of this trajectory towards orthodoxy. So therefore, Matthew, being more reverential in terms of this orthodox tradition, must be written after Mark.
Mm.
Luke must be written after Mark. So I think that that's a problem, this evolutionary plotting of these Gospels. And another problem with this is that the evolutionary model here, it doesn't take seriously this wide array of early Christological beliefs within the canon itself. So as I've mentioned, Paul's writing prior to the Gospels. Paul's writing in the 50s. The Gospels start getting written in the late 60s to the 90s. And Paul is an example of a high Christology much earlier than the Gospels. Whereas James is really only minimally concerned with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
James is much more behavioral. And I'm not trying to say that the gospel authors knew Paul or knew James.
Right,
I'm just trying to demonstrate here that high and low Christologies were present very early.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some of my problems with this theological development
within
early Christianity and how the gospels get plotted along this assumption of a pretty lockstep movement to
mm-hmm.
orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, I'm just going to mention a couple of double standards that I see happening here. One, so when Markan prioritists are unable to explain some aspect of the evidence, they default to historical ignorance.
Yeah.
So this is a quote from Streeter. "In estimating the probability of Matthew or Luke purposely omitting any whole section of their source. We should remember that they did not regard themselves merely as scribes, professedly reproducing exactly the manuscript in front of them, but as independent authors making use, like all historians, of earlier authorities and electing from these what seemed to be the most important. When compression of some kind is necessary, slight reasons might decide in favor of rejections. But even when we can detect no particular motive, we cannot assume that there was none, for we cannot possibly know either all the circumstances of churches or all the personal idiosyncrasies of writers so far removed from our own time. So essentially, if we can't make sense of it, it's just because we don't know. We can't know. So this argument is a really convenient way for Streeter to avoid dealing with the complications of his two-document hypothesis. So if sense can't be made of a particular decision within the model, then one can always fall back on the inability to know authorial intent. And the problem here, for me, it's not the claim to ignorance, because there really is just so much we can't know. Historical work is always incredibly limited. And once we decide we know something, the Dead Sea Scrolls are discovered and everything is upended for the next 60 years.
Yep.
Things like that. But my problem here is that the same argument is never permitted in favor of Markan posteriori.
Yep.
So for Streeter, only a, quote, lunatic would remove the infancy narratives and blocks of Jesus' teaching from Matthew's gospel. So Mark would never cut out the Sermon on the Mount and the birth narrative.
He's not that guy.
Only a lunatic would do that. And only a lunatic would believe that Mark could do that. So rather than acknowledge that the omission is a possibility, and with evidence from Marcion, a probability, because Marcion was accused of chopping out parts of Luke, including the infancy narrative.
Yeah.
So there's at least polemical evidence, although there's scholars now think that Marcion was just actually working with a different version of Luke, that he didn't cut it out, that it was just he had there. A version who didn't have it.
Yeah.
And that some of the arguments on Marcion were polemical to discredit him, because they're saying he's butchering the story and he just had a different version.
Yeah, yeah.
Regardless, the idea that somebody could cut those out, whether somebody did or not, is a possibility even in antiquity.
Yeah.
So Streeter, even with that evidence, knowing about Marcion, he totally discredits the notion out of hand with this pejorative comment of lunacy. And if a compelling case in Streeter's view cannot be stated to explain Mark's abridgment of his predecessors, then the possibility of Markan posteriority is dismissed out of hand. Even if he can't fully explain Markan priority, he can just default to ignorance. I think that's a bit of a double standard.
Too convenient
that you can be ignorant, but your opponents can't.
Yep.
A second double standard I see is this conflation of sources. Proponents of Q spill a lot of ink describing the ways that Matthew and Luke conflate and connect their sources. However, criticisms abound concerning the possibility of Mark conflating and connecting Matthew and Luke. Most problematic is the number of omissions required for Mark's gospel to take its form. Why would Mark leave so much out of his sources? So this argument assumes that Matthew and Luke must have combined most of Mark with most of Q. We do know that a small amount of Mark is in neither Matthew or Luke, though not so much as to be problematic. There's very, very little that's not taken over. I think it's like one healing story and a little bit of something else. But assuming that Q was an actual document, we have no way of knowing how much of Q was actually reproduced and what portions of special M and special L might have been from Q. And that Luke outright rejected stuff that Matthew liked and vice versa. So because we can't know this, it's really difficult to proceed with a fair assessment of how sources might be used. So we saw how Matthew and Luke used Mark. So then we're going to say something about how they must have used Q, even though we can't possibly know.
That's a big assumption.
Yeah. And the argument is that Luke followed Q more closely than Matthew. I don't know what the defense of that argument is. And that more of it's reproduced in Luke. But that doesn't make sense if Luke was more close to Q when he only used about half of Mark. So there's like some flaws there. It just doesn't make sense, this conflation of sources. You have to start with some assumptions about Q's existence to make this argument.
A lot of assumptions.
And there's no way to know.
Yeah.
And then fine, Finally, Q can be void of the passion, but Mark can't be void of an infancy narrative.
Yeah.
So certainly communities of Jesus followers were aware of the circumstances of Jesus' death. Now, whether or not his death had any particular meaning to each individual community is really what's at issue here.
Right.
So Q scholars obviously are very intrigued by the idea that Q would be lacking in passion narrative. Again, we can't know, but if Q is double tradition material and passion is triple tradition, then passion can't be in Q. So that's really interesting to Q scholars that this passion narrative would not exist. But so Kloppenborg, for example, he can readily imagine this community that's unconcerned with the death of Jesus, but he cannot entertain that Mark's community might not have valued Jesus' teaching. And the teaching and the infancy narratives really get interlaced in Luke's infancy narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So if Luke has an infancy narrative that stresses Jesus as a teacher, of him going to the temple, Kloppenborg cannot imagine that Mark's community would not be interested in that.
Yeah.
Even though Mark is like really just works of power. It's just not compelling to me. Like, you can imagine the passion narrative not mattering, but you can't imagine an infancy narrative not mattering if you knew about it.
Right.
So the assumption is, if Mark knew Luke and Matthew in these infancy narratives, there's no way he wouldn't have incorporated one or both or conflated them.
Which is, again, a huge
even though assumption. Q can totally not care just about the death and resurrection of Jesus. So it's baffling to me that we can have one or the other. So very quickly, a couple of paths forward that I think might be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I mentioned narrative criticism. I think that it helps us get away from those questions of historicity that cannot be answered and can help us make sense of these stories as narrative holes. Like, why within Mark do the disciples need to look so bad?
Yeah.
What is Mark trying to do with that? That doesn't have to do with anything of if Peter really was the turd that I think he was.
Mm-hmm.
Every text around Peter really has him being very abrasive and gruff. I think he must have just been a really unbearable person.
Probably.
Another way, empire studies. I think in exploring the ways that these gospels are negotiating their imperial context, I really think it could indicate something about the concerns of these different authors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So perhaps for Mark, the teaching of Jesus was not as useful as the actions of Jesus for demonstrating how God's empire is interrupting Roman rule.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So these works of power are far more important for Mark, possibly. And empire studies might help us illuminate something about that. And then finally, orality studies. And this is where I think some more work could be done. So for ancient audiences, you would have encountered the gospel in any of these texts, 95% of you, if not more, would have heard it. You would not have read it. And these texts would not have belonged to an individual. They would have belonged to a community.
Mm-hmm.
And so thinking about this, so even though they're being written to preserve and to support orality, not to replace it.
Yeah.
And that's hard for us to understand. So thinking about these ancient performances of these, because it wouldn't just be this rote reading.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been very dynamic and engaging performances of these stories. So thinking about this, so what performative differences, for instance, might there be between, say, a Greek novel and a rhetorical handbook?
Yeah.
Very different.
Yeah.
So maybe, one, is time a concern? Mark is much shorter than Matthew and Luke.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and Mark, it has been argued, is very well suited for performance.
Mm-hmm.
It runs about 2 hours, and that's a good time window. Matthew would probably run you about 4.
Yeah, it'd be a long time.
It'd be a long time. So could Mark possibly have abridged Matthew and Luke for the purpose of performance in a manageable amount of time? And thinking about that, would the difference in the miracles versus the teaching of Jesus be why Mark rejects these large blocks of teaching? Because they just don't really work well for the performance?
Mm-hmm.
Did the didactic nature of that slow down the drama that was being created by these acts of power? The oral nature of Mark is really well documented. Even Streeter acknowledges the oral tendencies of this gospel, but he cannot imagine the gospel being penned for performance using other written gospels as sources. So he writes, Mark reads like a shorthand account of a story by an impromptu speaker with all the repetitions, redundancies, and digressions which are characteristic of living speech. But I think that the oral nature of Mark might help us to understand some of how he wrote. For instance, Kloppenburg, following Goodacre, writes, Mark's gospel is full of themes and phrases redolent of the Lord's Prayer. Mark had every reason to retain the Lord's Prayer, so congenial was it to his depiction of Jesus. Yet Mark does not reproduce it. And this makes no sense to a lot of scholars.
Yeah.
Because if he would have, his text is very reminiscent of the Lord's Prayer, but he doesn't actually reproduce it. And if he had Matthew and Luke, he had two versions of the Lord's Prayer. He could have picked one or combined them.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't. So therefore, he couldn't have written after them. That's not logical to them. But I think that John Miles Foley's work offers us a way out of that dilemma. So Foley refers to these types of allusions that Mark is making to the Lord's Prayer all throughout as metonymic, meaning that in this case, these allusions are themes that call to mind the Lord's Prayer,
mm-hmm.
And are put in place specifically to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps it's not that Mark inadvertently omitted the Lord's Prayer, but instead wove the prayer into the fabric of his gospel, and thereby is constantly pulling the prayer back to the forefront of the audience's mind. Perhaps Mark skillfully and metonymically weaves other teaching into the fabric of the gospel beyond the Lord's Prayer, capturing Jesus' teaching in a way that constantly engages the hearer.
Yeah.
Maybe not. I think it's an area to be pursued.
Possibly.
I think orality studies actually could help make a little bit of sense of some of this if it were really pursued. And those are just some ideas that I quickly came up on. So
yeah.
So that's the synoptic problem, the problem, the terms, the evidence,
mm-hmm.
the cover stories, the problems that I see. I'm sure there are others, and there might be some who think that I'm crazy, and maybe some pathways forward for readdressing this. I think we've covered a lot of ground in a couple of episodes.
Yeah.
Whew.
I think that's all we can say about it.
Now, y'all have to pick a side. Maybe we'll set up a, after you've listened to both these episodes, you can vote on a Twitter poll or something. Let us know where you stand.
Which one do you like best?
Which one do you like best? So, alrighty, I think that's it.
See you next time.
See you next time. Amen and Selah.